Marina waits a good 10 minutes after the first 250 cc's for his stomach to settle before delivering the rest. When given too rapidly, he gets too full too fast, nauseous, and vomits. Liquid gold has a foul, acidic, nutty flavor on the way up that makes him cringe just thinking about it. That stuff was never meant to be tasted. Thankfully, Karina takes her time. When Friends is over and the final food syringe is emptied, Karina dissolves his evening meds in water and delivers that through the syringe as well. The water feels cool and refreshing and weirdly quenches his thirst without ever touching his lips. She then flushes the tubing two more times with water, recaps the Mickey button, and lowers Richard's lifted shirt. There, done with dinner or his nightcap or his feeding or whatever this is called. His stomach is now filled with 500 calories and a half liter of liquid. He can't say that he's hungry, but he's hardly sated. Although the service was impeccable, he'd give the meal itself a one-star Yelp rating. He remembers when he first started touring, he ordered steak from room service every night. By maybe the eighth or ninth night, he couldn't stomach even the thought of one more steak. He'd had his fill. He ordered pizza and didn't touch another steak for months. The only item on the room service menu now is liquid gold, every meal for 23 days straight and counting. What he wouldn't give now for a medium-rare, dry-aged New York strip. He tries not to think about food. For one, it's torture to imagine what he can never again have. Second, like Pavlov's dog anticipating the steak his master is about to plop in its dish after the bell is rung, remembering food makes Richard's mouth water. While the peg tube eliminates the potential threats of eating and drinking, he still has to contend with his own saliva, which, like any liquid, can go down the wrong pipe when swallowed. Even with the help of the glycopyrrolate, his drool, which has for some reason become the consistency of Elmer's glue, is constantly accumulating, either spilling over his bottom lip and hanging from his chin in shimmering stringy ribbons, or gurgling at the back of his mouth. Thinking about steak turned the faucet on. He's gurgling. Karina flips on his new suctioning machine, pokes the wand into his mouth and slides it around in there, vacuuming between his teeth and gums and under his tongue, slurping up his excessive spit, drying out his flooding mouth. He feels like he's at the dentist every time she does this. The second big discovery at his clinic appointment was the treacherous state of his breathing. His forced vital capacity, the amount of air he's able to forcibly exhale, was down to 42%. Over the past 3 months, he'd started to notice that he was regularly out of breath when walking from room to room, that he had to pause every 4 or 5 words when talking because he was out of air, and that he was speaking only on the exhales.
"Are you waking up throughout the night?" asked his doctor.
"Yes."
"Are you starting the day already fatigued?"
"Yes."
"And do you have a headache when you wake up?"
He did, almost every morning for weeks.
"You're hypoventilated during the night. You're not getting in enough oxygen, and you're retaining too much carbon dioxide. I want you on a BiPAP."
He had no idea that his insomnia and morning headaches were due to a continual lack of air throughout the night. So now he sleeps with a mask attached to a machine by a long tube. It's 10 o'clock, and the only thing left on his exciting daily itinerary is getting hooked up to the BiPAP. Karina fills the humidifier and plugs it in. Richard watches her weary but focused eyes as she works. She applies Vaseline with her pinky to the many raw sores on his face. The moist air and prolonged contact of the mask against his skin every night have caused it to break down, creating a painful rash. He tried switching to nasal pillows instead of a full-face mask, but he couldn't keep his mouth closed while sleeping and found wearing the chin strap to keep it shut too aggravating. So he wears the full mask and endures the sores. Karina wipes her hands on a towel, turns the BiPAP on, then secures the mask over his nose and mouth. The relief is instantaneous. Initiated by his own inhale, air is forced in. His lungs fully inflate, and his rib cage expands. When he exhales, the machine inverts the pressure, and air is forced out as if his lungs were a pair of bellows and the machine were pressing the handles together. Every night, in this moment when Karina seals the mask onto his face, he realizes exactly how labored and shallow his breathing has been all day.
as if he's been wearing a tight corset around his lungs since morning, and Karina finally released it. With the mask on his face, he breathes an abundant flow of sweet oxygen in and carbon dioxide out, and a deep tension lifts out of his body like steam rising off a hotcake. He won't suffocate in the night. His pulmonologist says that his forced vital capacity appears to be declining at about 3% per month. The BiPAP is only capable of producing pressure that supports breathing. It doesn't breathe for him. It breathes with him. At some point, the BiPAP will no longer sustain him. The only options then will be death or a tracheostomy tube coupled with mechanical ventilation and 24/7 care. Like the medium-rare dry-age New York strip, he tries not to think about it. While the introduction of the BiPAP has meant a better night's sleep for Richard, it has meant the opposite for Karina. She adjusts the mask, making sure it's entirely sealed, knowing without question that, like all things, the seal is temporary. When he yawns, when he scrunches up his nose because it itches, when he turns his head to the right, the mask can come loose. If it does, the machine will then sound an alarm, and Karina will have to get up to readjust the mask, several times a night. She sleeps on the couch in the living room now to shorten her commute. He's like a newborn, and Karina is the sleep-deprived new mother, a walking zombie. But with newborns, there is light at the end of the tunnel. The baby starts eating solid food or gains weight or turns one. Some developmental milestone is achieved, and miraculously the baby sleeps through the blessed night. There is no light at the end of this tunnel. No developmental milestone that will graduate Richard from needing assistance all hours of the night. Unless they consider his death a milestone. Maybe Karina does. He watches her face, her pretty green eyes. She's inspecting the perimeter of his mask, but because the mask is over the midline of his face, it looks as if she were studying him. Her eyes appear dull, disconnected from the source of any internal spark. Her long hair is gathered into a low ponytail, but a section from the front has fallen loose, draping over her right eyebrow. He wants to reach out and tuck it behind her ear. She looks him in the eye and sighs. He wants to tell her that he's sorry that she's so tired. He's sorry that he has this and had nowhere else to go. He's sorry he's become such a burden to her, and then suddenly, strangely, for the first time, he wants to tell her that he's sorry for all of it. And he's sorry without the usual accessories, the excuses that absolve him or an equivalent list of her crimes weighing down the other side of the scale, blaming her, making them even. There is only his apology. He's sorry he was so careless with her, their family, their life. He's sorry that he cheated on her, that he didn't know what to do with his loneliness, that he felt unappreciated, unseen, unloved by her, and didn't know how to talk to her about it. He was lonelier in bed with Karina than anywhere else on the planet. He never told her. He remembers those green eyes looking straight at him, simmering with resentment, punishing him, looking straight through him, indifferent, shunning him. He was too afraid to ask her what was wrong, too afraid to hear her answer. They never talked about any of it. They were complicit in their mutual silence. Her exhausted eyes, likely praying that the mask stays put for at least a couple of hours, connect with his. He wants to tell her now that he's sorry, before she leaves the room, before this revelation and urge to confess evaporate, before he goes to sleep, and, as if it were a dream in the nighttime, he awakens in the morning with only the vaguest sense of having known something. He holds his apology like a helium balloon, the slip-knotted string fast loosening from his wrist, soon to be a dot in the stratosphere. He has to say it now, or possibly never. "I'm sorry." But his voice, already thin and weak like the rest of him, can't be heard through the mask, over the vacuum cleaner-like whir of the BiPAP. "Good night," she says. Karina turns off the TV and the light, leaving the door open a crack, as she disappears from his room without ever hearing him, not knowing.
Chapter 17. Finished with his morning shift, Bill walks into the sunlit but chilly living room, leaving the door to the den wide open. Cuddled under a blanket on the couch and draining the last still hot sip of her second cup of coffee, Karina is distracted by this, bothered even, as if she'd witnessed someone leave a bed unmade or the cap off a tube of toothpaste, nagging her like an aggressive itch she can't yet scratch. She doesn't keep the den door wide open. She can't shut it entirely as she would prefer, as Richard would be trapped inside, but there needs to be some physical, visible barrier between them. She keeps the den door positioned open only a crack, creating at least a semblance of separation and privacy. She feels safer that way. Not wanting to reveal this probably diagnosable compulsion to Bill, she'll close the den door to an inch shy of shut after he goes. Then she'll finally take a shower. Karina anticipates their daily goodbye as Bill checks a text on his phone. Done, he looks up at her, but instead of offering his usual cheery hug and a kiss on the cheek, he stands there with his arms crossed, studying Karina as if she were a math problem he can't quite figure out, or a piece of art that sort of offends him, but he's not sure why. Okay, girlfriend, my 1:30 just canceled. Kenzia will be here with Richard then. You're meeting me for coffee. I can put on a pot here if you want some coffee. No, you're getting out of this house and we need to chat. About what? About you, he says, assertive and concerned. Me? She's suddenly self-conscious about her bedhead and sweatpants, that she's not wearing a bra under her t-shirt or any makeup, and that she doesn't smell so good. I'm fine. You are so not fine. Ryan Gosling in The Notebook is fine. You're Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler. Mortified, she wants to pull the blanket she's wrapped in up and over her head. I'm just telling it like I see it. I haven't showered yet, she confesses, as if this weren't obvious. And I've already had 2 cups of coffee, and I can't have any more caffeine or I won't sleep at all tonight. You can order decaf. Honestly, I'm okay, Bill. Decaf coffee at 1:30, or we're going for martinis after I get off work tonight at 6:30. And don't throw any more excuses at me, 'cause I have a really big bat, and I'll just keep hitting him back at you. I'm good. You're bad. I can't leave at 6:30. Kevin's only here until 6. Bill squints at her through his black-rimmed glasses as if he were contemplating his next move in a game of chess. You're driving me nuts. He checks his phone again. Okay, my next visit lives nearby, so let's do this now. Come. He marches into the kitchen, a man on a mission, and not knowing what else to do, Karina follows him. They sit opposite each other at the square breakfast table. He looks into her eyes and says nothing, taking her in, and she feels so utterly exposed and yet safely held in his gaze that she finds herself working hard not to cry. Okay, honey, tell me what is going on. I need to know more about this situation. What do you mean? I mean about the two of you. Not for nothing, but the tension in this house is killing me. Karina sits back in her chair, blinking, stunned. She thought she'd been nothing but perfectly civil, polite, and dutiful around Richard, especially in front of Bill, whom she adores and admires and wants to impress. She can feel the razor-sharp point of every edge between Richard and her, but she assumed their animosity was traveling on a private, restricted highway. She didn't think Bill or anyone else visiting or tending to Richard could possibly pick up on it. Really? You both do anything to avoid making eye contact with each other? Seriously, if you're in the same room, your eyes dart around so much I practically have to sit down. I'm so dizzy. Well, you know we're divorced, she says in a hushed voice, not wanting Richard to hear her through the wide-open den door, wondering what details he's already shared with Bill. Are you ever going to talk about your whole history? To you? To Richard. She pauses. She didn't see that coming. She picks at a flake of skin on her chapped bottom lip with her thumb, smelling her coffee breath on her hand as she does. The skin peels too far without letting go, and a quick pinch stops her from continuing. She licks her lip, tasting blood. Bill waits, watching her. Part of the reason we divorced is because we don't know how to talk to each other. Look, I don't walk in your shoes, but I see what I see, and I've been through a lot. I've lost people close to me, and in the end, it's all about peace of mind and closure. You gotta get to forgiveness. She has taken Richard in. She pulls down his underpants so he can pee. She wipes his urine off the toilet seat and the floor when he's done. She suctions mucus out of his mouth all day. She reseals that damn mask onto his face all night. She pushes liquid food and water through a syringe into his stomach. She makes sure the den door is cracked open instead of shut so he can come and go. And a thousand other things. Now she's supposed to forgive him too? She wants to do the right thing, and she wants to please Bill. But she's maxed out. Totally tapped. I can't do any more than what I'm already doing for Richard. She crosses her arms over her chest. Sweetheart, forgiving Richard is for you, not for him. She softens her stance, surprised to be considering this perspective. Forgiving Richard would be for me. Could that really be true? She tries it on, but instead of feeling true like the sky is blue, it feels more like the sky is infinite space extending through more than 100 billion galaxies. It could be true, but she can't comprehend it. I don't know if you fully grasp this, but he's probably not going to live to be 90. I know. I wouldn't wait too long then. You might just miss your chance. Bill looks her straight in the eye, making sure his words landed. And her heart beats faster, as if it's been warned or dared or threatened. She nods, but has no idea yet what she's agreeing to. I gotta run. But also, honey, please. You gotta take care of yourself. I've seen too many caregivers burn out. You gotta get out of this house and have time that's just for you.
I walk with Elise every week.
That's not enough. What about meeting someone? Like a man? Yes, a man. Or a woman, if you're into it. Whichever. A date.
No.
She shakes her head for emphasis, dismissing the suggestion. Look at you. You're beautiful. Or you would be after a long shower and some makeup and maybe a trip to the mall.
The last thing I need is another man to take care of. Thank you.
I'm not telling you to marry him, for God's sake. I'm talking someone to wine and dine you. And getting laid wouldn't hurt either, girl. I'm just saying. You know I love you.
Thanks. I'm good.
Okay. Bill stands, not believing her, but satisfied enough for now, needing to go. But find something outside of this that's just for you. ALS is gonna take Richard down. Don't let it take you too. He kisses the top of her head and leaves the kitchen. She stays in her seat, listening to the squeaky sound of his rubber-soled footsteps on the hardwood floor of the living room and in the front foyer, the rising chord progression of his coat zipper, the questioning intonation of the front door as it creaks open, and the satisfying thump of it closing all the way shut. Chapter 18. Karina and Elise walk together every week, regardless of the weather. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of early dawn keeps them from completing their 3-mile loop. It's an admirable policy in theory, but questionable on mornings such as this, when the temperature with the wind chill is below zero. They leave the paved roads of their neighborhood for the dirt path that encircles the reservoir, walking much faster than they normally do. The sharp, frigid air stings Karina's cheeks and seems to penetrate her brain through her exposed eyeballs, every blink a temporary shield, a a noticeable moment of relief. She wishes she'd remembered her sunglasses. The normally soft pine needle-strewn dirt path has no give, feeling petrified beneath her feet, the earth frozen solid. Frequent bursts of wind slice her body and steal her breath. It's too cold to be out here. It's almost too cold to talk. She definitely needs more help, says Grace, walking fast behind Elisa's heels as if pursuing her. Grace arrived home yesterday for a long weekend. Before bed, Karina invited Grace to join her and Elise in the morning, but didn't pin any hopes and dreams on Grace's actually coming. A night owl who hates the cold and hasn't seen 6 a.m. since elementary school, Grace didn't verbalize any interest, and Karina took her non-answer to mean, thanks but no thanks. So Karina was more than a little surprised and happy to see her daughter dressed and waiting at the front door when Karina was ready to leave. It's been a month since Grace was last home. It feels like a year. In December, Karina came and went without too much thought regarding Richard's safety. He could always reach her on her cell. But his voice has significantly weakened since Christmas, and the voice activation app on his phone can't reliably comprehend his muted, slurred speech. His whole life has changed in 1 month. He needs Karina's help regularly, throughout the day and night, and so her whole life has changed too. She worries about leaving him alone, but she's not giving up her weekly walk. He'll be fine. What about his father and brothers? Asks Elise. They're not going to take him in, says Karina. How do you know if you don't ask? Believe me, I know. They can at least give you some money for more help. I can do it. Richard has 30 hours a week of home health aides, not covered by insurance. The rest is on Karina. But why do you want to? Yeah, Mom. What are you trying to prove? Karina's not sure. Maybe having Richard in the house gives her something useful to do. Something that fills the many hours every day when she's not teaching children to play piano. When Grace moved to Chicago, an enormous, lonely void moved into Karina's home and heart. No amount of therapy, chocolate, wine, sleep, or Netflix could evict it. Richard, in the den with ALS, has elbowed out some of the void, which is admittedly strange, as his presence had never before been the cure for her loneliness. Are these really her only two options? Live with Richard, or live with the void? She must be a saint, or a martyr, or screwed up. It's not forever. That's what Jane Wilde thought. Who? Asks Grace. Stephen Hawking's first wife, says Elise. They were in their 20s when he was diagnosed, and she married him anyway, thinking he only had a couple of years left. He's in his 70s now. So Dad could live that long? If for some reason the disease stops progressing, says Karina, not believing this is possible in Richard's case, given the decline he's experienced in the past month. Or if he gets a trach and goes on a ventilator. You can't do this indefinitely, Karina. I know. If he goes on a ventilator, he needs to move to a facility. She's not a nurse, and she's not his wife. He'd probably qualify for some kind of assisted living now, says Elise. I'm okay for now. I don't get it, says Grace. You couldn't stand living with him. You said the day you moved out was the happiest day of your life. Karina bristles. She shouldn't have said such a thing within ear's distance of Grace. Karina's hoping she didn't lack all judgment and say this directly to Grace. She might have. She doesn't ask. Let me look after him for a few hours here and there. How about Tuesday and Wednesday evenings? Asks Elise. No, I couldn't ask you to do that. You're not asking. I am. No, really, I'm okay. I could at least come over and keep you company. Reluctantly, Karina acquiesces. Okay. Elise puts an arm around Karina and hugs her as they walk. I'm worried about leaving you alone with Dad. I'm not alone.
Elise is coming over Tuesday and Wednesday evenings. Don't worry, honey. I have plenty of help. You don't. And this is only going to get harder. You realize this, right? Karina does, but she doesn't answer Grace or acknowledge her with a nod. Karina keeps walking, her frozen eyeballs focused on the ground. One step at a time. Maybe I should stay home and take this semester off.
No, you're not doing that, says Karina.
What if I figured out a way to do the next semester at BU or Northeastern?
No, we're not discussing this. Your father would never want you to do that for him.
I'd be doing it for you, not him. As much as Karina would love for Grace to stay, to help with Richard and fill the void, she won't risk Grace's future. Karina knows all too well that a life derailed, even for a short time, can't always find its way back to its original track. She never even made it back to the station. No, she won't let Grace pause her studies, her relationship with Matt, her pursuit of happiness for a semester. For one second. Especially not for Richard. She won't let Grace make the same mistake she made. That pattern ends with her. Restless ghosts of unresolved resentment rise to the surface, as full and fresh and haunting as they were 20 years ago, 10 years ago, last week. Karina lets the aching pain run through her. The tragic story of how Richard ruined her life, welcoming it for its familiarity, for the way it makes her feel justified. You're not disrupting your life out there.
You're disrupting yours, says Grace.
That's different.
She has a point, says Elise. You're not exactly moving on if Richard is living in the den.
Can you see your mom bringing a date home? This is the living room, and that's my ex-husband in the den.
Richard isn't keeping me from dating. I'm not interested in dating.
What are you interested in, then? Asks Elise.
Getting warm. Ending this conversation.
How about coming with me and my students on the New Orleans trip?
I can't this year.
Why?
Her ex-husband in the den.
I think you like having Richard around to blame for things. It's like a comfortable habit.
Karina hates to admit it, but there is truth to this. If she blames him, she never has to blame herself.
You can hire help for a few days, someone to stay the nights, says Elise.
I can't.
You won't.
Fine, I won't.
Why?
Karina doesn't answer because she doesn't know.
Or maybe she's beginning to, but can't yet articulate it. She senses something like a program running in the background, an awareness creeping up the basement stairs of her subconscious. Maybe this horrible, bizarre living situation is giving her and Richard a chance at resolution, at forgiveness. She considers this possibility, first suggested by Bill last week, as the three walk in silence, Elise and Grace waiting patiently for an answer. Karina would like to forgive Richard for uprooting them to Boston, for missing most of Grace's childhood, for cheating on her, betraying and humiliating her, robbing her of happiness. She's tried many times over the years. After giving it much thought, she believes Bill, that forgiving Richard would be good for her.
What's the saying?
Not forgiving someone is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. But she hasn't been big enough or spiritually evolved enough or brave enough to do it. Richard is sick and dying, and she still can't let him off the hook. Making him wrong allows her to feel right, and feeling right is her drug of choice. And she'd like to be forgiven, but she can't bring herself to apologize to Richard, to say the words. She's handcuffed by shame, and a stubborn, self-righteous logic that supports her side of the story. She had her reasons. Maybe her actions now can be the words she's still too afraid to offer.
I don't know, says Karina.
I could come back for that, says Grace.
Go to New Orleans.
No, you don't need to.
How many days is it?
Asks Grace.
Four,
says Elise. Thursday to Sunday, first week of March.
I can do that.
It's too much, says Karina.
It's 4 days, Mom.
I mean, it's too much taking care of him. I'm up all night.
I'm young. I stay up all night all the time.
I got this. You're going to New Orleans.
Elise smiles, patting Grace on the back. I love this girl. They reach the beginning of the trail where they began. Before stepping off the path and onto the paved road of their neighborhood, Karina looks back for a moment at the frozen reservoir, at the loop they just completed. Like her morning walk, her thoughts and emotions run in circles. Richard is living with her again, and caring for him is more than she can handle, but she can't ask him to leave, and her entire life is a circle. She's trapped, never getting anywhere.
Okay, I'll go to New Orleans.
Grace and Elise high-five, celebrating their victory, but Karina doesn't join in. The trip is a month away. As she's recently learned, anything can happen in a month. They stop in the street in front of their houses to say a brief goodbye. Grace and Elise hug, and Elise wishes her good luck at school. Karina checks the time on her phone. They've been gone for 45 minutes. She hurries to the front door, anxious to get inside, to sit at the table in her warm kitchen with a cozy hot cup of coffee. She swings open the door, and her stomach drops. Without thinking, she runs toward the den, toward the piercing sound of the BiPAP alarm. Chapter 19. Karina barrels into the den, breathless. Richard is propped up in his hospital bed, the mask askew on his face, much like it was at 4 a.m. He smiles sheepishly beneath it. She quickly sizes up the situation. He's fine. But instead of feeling relieved, she's pissed, as if he's played the same cruel trick on her for the millionth time, and she stupidly fell for it.
Is he okay?
Asks Grace, running in right behind her mother, her voice high and terrified. He's fine. Grace looks him over, assessing the state of her father herself. His face is alert and calm. He's clearly breathing. Geez. Okay, I'm gonna take a shower, says Grace, only temporarily inconvenienced by the false alarm, her spiked emotional temperature already back to normal. But Karina's heart is still feverish, adrenaline whipping through her body, searching for danger. The shrill sound of that damn alarm sends shockwaves through her nervous system, activating some automatic primal instinct for crisis. She can't seem to override her response to it. But nothing about the BiPAP machine is yet life and death. He can still breathe without it. He breathes entirely on his own without it all day long. It only assists him at night. So the sound of the BiPAP alarm shouldn't send her running. The sound of his choking on rivers of goopy spit is life-threatening. He could aspirate and develop pneumonia. But oddly, she often ignores the first minute or more of these routine seismic coughing fits, listening patiently and somewhat annoyed from another room, hoping he'll work it out on his own. He almost never does. She turns the BiPAP and the humidifier off, silencing the alarm, then pulls the mask up and over his head.
I am a bee.
Of all the undignified ALS-related chores, she hates the morning pee the most. She swears he yawns or turns his head on purpose, breaking the seal on the mask, sounding the alarm so she'll magically materialize before him. He then wants her to unhook him from the machine so he can get up and use the bathroom. She shouldn't resent him for having to pee in the morning, but she does. It's always about 7 a.m. when he makes this request, shocking her out of a dead sleep. She begins almost every day exhausted, hollowed out and nauseated from lack of sleep. Granted, she's already up today, but normally she's out cold at 7. Bill comes at 9. Why can't he just lie there and wait for Bill?
She should be grateful that he doesn't piss the bed. He swings his legs over the side of the bed and worms his butt to the edge. Using his weakening core, he works to pull himself to standing. She watches him struggle and doesn't offer a hand. She follows him out of the den, through the living room, and into the first floor bathroom. He stands in front of the toilet waiting for her. She pulls his boxers down to his ankles and he steps out. She picks his shorts up off the floor and rests them on the vanity, keeping them safely dry. He stands over the bowl, thrusts his bony hips forward, and pees. She crosses her arms and grits her teeth, irritated with him for not sitting. Granted, sitting doesn't guarantee that everything will land neatly in the toilet, but she feels the odds are better. What does he care if he misses? He's not the one who has to clean up the mess. She closes her eyes, an absurd and unnecessary offer of privacy, listening for him to finish. She can tell by the intermittent sound of trickling, of urine splashing into water and then nothing, that he's peeing all over the floor. Just as she predicted. She's sweating, stifling hot beneath her winter coat and hat, which she still hasn't had time to remove. She wonders when she's going to get her cup of coffee. When he's done, he presents himself to her. She squats in front of him, holding open each hole of his boxers for him to step into. She pulls them up.
Can I put on my head mask?
Give me a minute. I have to clean up this mess. He leaves her, his ex-wife, his dutiful, unpaid, unthanked nursemaid, to the job of wiping up his piss. She unzips and removes her coat and hat, sprays disinfecting cleaner all over the toilet seat and floor, and wipes everything dry with a wad of paper towels. There. Clean. Until the next time he pees. While washing her hands in the sink longer than necessary, she studies her face in the mirror. Her mouth is turned down at the corners, a resting frown. Her skin and eyes are dull. Her hair is flat and oily. She hasn't bothered washing it in days. She needs a long, hot shower. She needs a good long nap. She needs breakfast and a cup of coffee. But instead, she has to return to Richard's room to stick a silver head mouse dot to the tip of his nose. It will take 2 seconds, but he gets to go first, and she hates him for it. Back in the den, he's sitting at the desk in front of his laptop waiting for her. She peels a dot from the sticker strip and presses it onto the tip of his big nose. He begins typing, selecting letters one at a time by aiming his nose at the keyboard displayed on the screen. As usual, Bill will get him showered and dressed when he arrives at 9. While she's in there, she opens the shades and strips the bed. With an armful of bedding, she's on her way to the laundry room when her eyes unintentionally catch the words, "Dear Dad," at the top of his computer screen. "You're writing to your father?"
"You're not supposed to see that. Don't read over my shoulder."
"I'm not. Are you asking him for help?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Why do we need help?"
She stares at the back of his head, incredulous. She's pretty sure her frowning mouth is hanging open. Maybe she misheard him. Did he really just ask, "Why do we need help?"
"Bill and the other aides do more summer heavy lifting. You do 1 meal a day, but other than that, I mostly stay under your hair."
She squeezes the sheets in her fists. She wants to pull every strand of hair out of his ungrateful head. Who does he think just wiped up his piss? Who will interrupt every piano lesson this afternoon to suck his mouth dry so the students don't have to listen to him sputter and gag between notes and worry that he's dying in the next room? Who is up all hours of the night, adjusting his mask so he can breathe?
Who does he think washes his bedding and clothes and takes him to doctor's appointments? But otherwise, yeah, he mostly stays out of her hair. I'm exhausted.
Your first lesson is not until afternoon. Why not you go back to bed?
Why don't you go to hell?
She drops the pile of bedding on the floor, marches out of the room, and shuts the door behind her. She doesn't want to see him. He can stay in there until Bill arrives. Standing in the living room, shaking with fury, she's unable to decide what to do. She's too angry to enjoy breakfast and a cup of coffee, too incensed to take a nap, and Grace is still in the shower. Karina stands there, paralyzed in her rage, and wonders what would happen if she stopped helping him. What would happen if the next time he chokes, she doesn't stop her piano lesson mid-note to suction him? At some point, the BiPAP won't simply be used for the quality of Richard's sleep. He'll need it all day and night for adequate ventilation. What happens when they reach that point in 1 month, in 2 months, this summer, and his mask comes loose in the night, and she ignores the sound of the BiPAP alarm? What if she awakens the next morning, refreshed from a full night's sleep, to find Richard with his mask askew, asphyxiated in the den? She stands in the living room, exhausted, unappreciated, unshowered, and hungry, wondering if she'd be charged with murder if he dies on her watch. Chapter 20. The first half of every piano lesson is devoted to technique. Scales in four octaves, Schmidt exercises, chords and arpeggios, training fingers and ears. The second half is focused on playing the piece of music assigned to the student the previous week. Ideally, the student has practiced 20 minutes a day at home. This student has not. Now that he's finished the technique part of his lesson, Karina waits for Dylan to begin playing, and every minute of waiting increases the temperature of her exasperation. Dylan is 13 and has probably grown 6 inches since last year. He's got long arms and fingers, knobby shoulders and knees, and appears uncomfortable in his own body, as if he hasn't quite moved into all that new space. Pink inflamed acne covers his otherwise pale face. A whisper of fuzzy brown hair has sprouted above his lip. He's wearing bright golden yellow shorts and a matching sweatshirt. His mother will shuttle him to basketball practice immediately after his piano lesson. Every few seconds, he snorts phlegm from somewhere in his throat up into his brain. "Would you like a tissue?" asks Karina.
"Huh? No, I'm good."
"No, you are not good," she wants to say. He studies the sheet music in front of him, as if reading Greek for the first time. Maybe he has a learning disability, or some kind of musical dyslexia or amnesia, and she shouldn't judge him. Or maybe he simply doesn't want to be here. That makes both of them. She was up half the night, and sitting on this bench in silence is draining the last drops of her depleted energy. Her eyelids rest shut for a second or two with each blink. She's desperate for a nap. Dylan lifts his left hand, but then retreats, placing it back onto his lap. He can't decide where to put his fingers. He won't even sample a note unless he's sure he's got it right. Millennials. They're all afraid to make a mistake. Dylan would rather sit on this bench, paralyzed in fear and indecision, than play the wrong note. If she just tells him, she can end this infuriating stalemate. But she's not going to. Not today. She provides the answers for this kid every week and he never learns. She blames his mother. She probably sits next to him while he does his homework and checks his answers, irons his clothes, wakes him up in the morning. The boy is helpless. Well, Karina is done coddling him. She sits and waits and says nothing, letting him sweat it out. He snorts again as he squints at the music, leaning closer to the sheet of paper, searching for where to put his left hand.
She's given him many bass clef mnemonics. All cows eat grass for the spaces. Good boys deserve fudge always for the lines. Or grizzly bears don't fly airplanes. No matter how it's packaged, he can't retain it and is forever perplexed by the arrangement of black dots on the five lines and four spaces of the bass clef.
She wishes he'd quit. She's tired of teaching students who don't want to play piano. She wishes all of them would quit. Aghast by this reckless thought, by the misfortune she just invited into her life, she crosses her fingers in her lap. How would she keep this roof over her head if that happened? She needs to be more careful about what she thinks. Dylan snorts again. He shouldn't be here with a chest cold. If Richard catches it, it could easily lead to pneumonia, and with ALS, that could be the end of him. She thinks about telling Dylan that they need to end the lesson early, but he doesn't have his license. They'd have to wait for his mother to pick him up, and his half-hour lesson would be done by the time she returns anyway. The indecipherable music in front of him is Prelude in C by Johann Sebastian Bach. No sharps, no flats. It's as simple a piece of music as she can imagine that is still lovely to play and hear. The first note is middle C. Granted, the note is written for the left hand, and so it's on the ledger line above the bass staff and not on the ledger line below the treble staff, as he's used to seeing it, but still, it's middle fucking C. His awkward presence and the even more awkward silence continue to provoke her, itching her hot, weary nerves, making her crazy. She grinds her teeth and breathes impatiently through her nose, suffering in her resistance. She will not tell him what to do, not one little hint. These kids are handed everything with a pretty little gold bow tied around it. Everyone's a winner. Everyone gets a trophy. Not on this bench. Welcome to real life, Dylan. He snorts again and she wants to scream. Play a note, blow your nose, do something. On another day, she might blame herself. If only she were a better teacher, more inspiring and encouraging, he'd know how to play this piece. Today, she's letting him own the blame. They'll both sit here for the remaining 10 minutes in silence if they have to. She gazes vaguely out the living room window and notices three birds in the distance, possibly doves, sitting on electrical wires, two on the top line, the third on the wire below them. These round black birds blur into treble clef notes that she plays in her desperately bored mind. G-G-E, G-G-E. She begins to compose a piece of music prompted by these avian notes, and her foul mood is somewhat lifted by the sweet melody when Richard's coughing intrudes. Not the sound she was hoping for. She listens for the shape and meaning of it, and hopes that, like young Dylan here, Richard will work it out on his own. The cough is wet and gurgling, unrelenting. Richard's abdominal muscles have weakened considerably in the past month, and he often can't produce a cough effective enough to simply clear his throat. To Dylan, it probably sounds as if someone were drowning in his own spit in the next room, but Karina has grown hardened to these now familiar noises. Richard suddenly goes quiet, and it's the silence between the bursts of choking that she never gets used to, that fill her with dread. She can picture him straining, his body shaking and taut with effort, as if he were trying to pull the cough up from his toes, the stringy vessels swelling in his neck, frothy spittle dripping over his mouth. She waits, listening, and she's reminded of years ago, lying awake in bed, waiting to hear the sound of the front door creaking open after midnight, the sound of Richard's heavy footsteps in the foyer, the wheels of his carry-on rolling across the hardwood floors. She resented him for being away, and then she immediately hated him for being home. Here he is, back home, and she still hates him. If the situation were reversed, if she was sick and Richard was stuck tending to her, everyone would canonize him.
No one makes her feel like a saint for doing this. She feels pathetic, foolish, resentful, and stupid. Probably how Dylan feels sitting at her piano for 30 minutes once a week. Richard coughs again, breaking the silence. He hacks and sputters, obviously fighting for air, and the sound of his failing to clear his throat crawls up Karina's spine and screeches in her ear. That's it. She's had enough. She stands abruptly, leaving Dylan in his endless confusion over Bach's impossible notes, and rages into the den. For the briefest moment, she considers the cough assist machine, but her heart and mind are saturated in a burning hot soup of hatred, and she can't take one more minute of any of this. She pulls out one of the two pillows from behind Richard's head and registers the split-second wide-eyed recognition in his eyes before she covers them and his entire face. His head moves side to side beneath the pillow, but not violently so. Paralyzed, his hands lie still by his side, unable to resist. She presses down harder. It takes only about a minute for his head to go still. She waits a bit longer before lifting the pillow. His eyes are open, his pupils fixed in place, uninhabited. She hears the sound of middle C.
Is that right?
Dylan asks. Karina blinks. The doves have taken flight from the electrical wires outside. She turns her head to see Bach's Prelude in C on the rack, and pulls herself fully back into the living room, releasing that sinful warm chocolate tort of a daydream. She listens as the pleasing tone of middle C fades, and Richard begins coughing in the den. Yes, Dylan. That's right. Congratulations. She checks the time on her watch. 4 o'clock. Lesson's over.
Chapter 21. Grace is sitting at Richard's desk, slumped and sullen, her body swiveled in the seat so she's angled toward the door, the way out, instead of facing him squarely. Aside from Karina and Bill and the other aides and doctors who are used to seeing people with ALS, most people choose not to face him directly. He's gaunt and often drooling, and his arms are lifeless and his voice is messed up. Strangers can tell by the quickest glance, because that's typically all they'll stay for, that something is really wrong with that guy. But he understands that, even if he were healthy, facing him is hard for Grace. He'd been watching Game of Thrones from his easy chair when she knocked on the slightly open door a few minutes ago and asked if she could come in, but she hasn't said a word since. She's clearly been sent in against her will, dutifully obeying her mother's directive. She keeps glancing down at her phone, possibly checking the time, wondering how long will be long enough for her to endure this non-conversation. She's been in here for 3 minutes, going on eternity. Or maybe she's reading texts. He can't tell. She's leaving for the airport in an hour, going back to school. This is goodbye.
I want you to know how expensive this gets. Your tuition money won't be tossed. Your education is safe.
Okay, thank you. Whatever he didn't give Grace growing up, at least he will have given her this. Are there any new drugs coming out soon that might cure it or at least slow it down? She asks, as if finally remembering something she planned to say.
In a clinical trial, maybe that'd be a magic bullet.
Oh, good. She seems satisfied and doesn't inquire any more on the topic. Like most 20-year-olds, she probably can't imagine death in any real way. So, of course, something will save him. And there it is, the solution, the clinical trial drug. Problem solved. She can move on to a safer, more palatable topic, or return to their mutually uncomfortable silence. Either way, no one's dying in this room. Every morning, Bill dissolves the mystery clinical trial pill in water and pushes it through the syringe into Richard's stomach. He wants to feel some kind of difference when this happens.
He can take a deeper breath, his articulation improves, the fasciculations in his tongue subside, he can miraculously wiggle his left thumb. But aside from the quenching cool rush of water filling his belly, he feels nothing. Maybe he's in the control group, or maybe, likely, this isn't the cure. But he stays in the trial not because he's betting on this little white pill. He's not deluded into thinking modern medicine can save him. He's already gone too far down the rabbit hole, and he knows it. It's too late for him to be saved. He's in the trial because he's doing his part, contributing this small step in the long march toward the cure. He figures every single thing that didn't work before scientists discovered the polio vaccine, for example, was necessary to get them to that cure. How many mistakes did he make in learning to play Chopin's Etude Opus 10, number 3? In learning any masterpiece before being able to play it flawlessly? On the road leading to any great achievement are 1,000 missteps, 1,000 more dead ends. Success cannot be born without the life and death of failure. Someday scientists will discover a vaccine, a prophylactic, a cure, and people will talk about ALS the way they talk about polio. Parents will tell their children that people used to get something called ALS and they died from it. It was a horrible disease that paralyzed its victims. Children will vaguely imagine the horror of it for a moment before skipping along to a sunnier topic, fleetingly grateful for a reality that will never include those three letters. But not yet. Today, there is only one lame excuse for a treatment and no cure, and children like Grace sit in front row seats, opposite their fathers, witnessing ALS in all its grotesque, unspeakable detail. Even if, by some miracle, his little white clinical trial pill was the magic bullet, at most it would stop the advancing ALS army from taking over any more territory, arresting the disease where it is. From what he understands, this drug can't rebuild what has already been destroyed, so he wouldn't get any worse, but nothing could be reversed. He'd still have two paralyzed arms and hands, a barely intelligible voice, difficulty breathing, a feeding tube, and a right foot that drops and trips him regularly. As much as the prospect of dying in 1 year freaks him out, a dozen more years of living like this is even more unappealing. It's downright terrifying if he dwells on it. He needs a magic pill and a time machine. He'd stop the disease and then go back in time, before ALS stole his hands, and then he'd go back even further, to when Grace was 2, when he started touring to play with faraway symphony orchestras, to when Grace was 4, when he was traveling to hide from Karina and her discontent, to when Grace was 6, and he'd teach her how to tie her shoes and ride a bike. He'd celebrate her 100% on spelling tests. He'd read bedtime stories to her and kiss her goodnight. To when she was 8, 9, 10. To know his daughter. But here they are instead, in the den, strangers saying goodbye. They have no time machine and no cure for ALS and no cure for this broken relationship. No supplements can fill all that was lost. No pills can be pushed through his peg tube to make everything right between them. She swivels her chair back and forth, then stops, her feet planted, as if she's decided something. It must be time for her to go. She folds her arms around her middle as if she were cold or feeling ill or protecting herself, and looks directly at him. "My whole childhood, I felt like you picked piano over me." It's one thing to house shortcomings and failures within the privacy of his own thoughts. It's another to hear the words aloud, publicly spoken by another, called out by his daughter. He feels a crashing wave of shame, and then, to his surprise, he's washed in relief. He holds his daughter's fierce gaze and feels so proud of her. "I did." Her face reads surprised, and her eyes don't know where to look. She wasn't expecting agreement. It's time to take responsibility, to accept blame, to be the grown-up, to be her father right now or never. She's going back to school. He might not have another chance. He wants to say more, to let her know that while he chose piano over her, he didn't love piano more. It was just easier for him to love piano than to show his love for her. He was good at piano. What if he wasn't a good father? What if he was like his father? Piano was consuming, demanding his full attention, his passion, his time. He'd have time for Grace later,
and later was always later. This is the biggest regret of his life. He was a terrible father. He didn't play a starring or even supporting role in her upbringing. At best, he was an ancillary, recurring character, and now he's a non-union extra with no line.